Radicalizing is deeply ingrained in gender. That is to say, becoming an extremist, talking neo-Nazis, white nationalists, Islamic State, the common bond there is men. But why is that? What draws young men into violent extremist groups? And what's the social glue that's keeping them together? Questions we're exploring here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Michael Kimmel is a distinguished professor of sociology and gender studies at Stony Brook University, where he founded the Center for the Study of Men and Masculinities. He's written several books. His latest is Healing from Hate, How Young Men Get Into and Out of Violent Extremism. Michael, welcome to the program.
Nice to be with you, Kate.
So you've been studying men and masculinity for some time now, but in this particular book, you really broaden out and look around the globe in Germany, Nordic countries, Britain. What is different in those countries about extremism and who is in these fringe groups versus what's happening here in the U.S.?
Well, this new project that I did across several countries, Healing from Hate, was really an outgrowth of earlier research that I had done specifically on the U.S. My previous book was called Angry White Men, and it really talked about why so many white men were so angry about so many things. And you don't have to look too far in the United States to see the evidence of this. So I looked, for example, at men's rights groups and father rights groups and school shooters, angry white boys, and the last chapter was about men who were in the radical right, the white nationalists, neo-Nazi skinheads, etc. And so I interviewed some of them, and through that process, I began to hear of these programs around the world that were designed to help guys get out of the movement. And I think this is, and I thought, well, that's a really optimistic idea that guys can, once they're in, they can actually turn their lives around. They can actually get out. So I started working with a few of those groups, and I ended up doing interviews in four different countries with different programs. A group called Exit in Sweden, which was really the first and major one that really has helped almost 800 young people who were in the skinhead neo-Nazi movement get out. And then a group called Exit in Germany. In the United States, there's a group called Life After Hate, which also has developed a kind of program to help guys get out of the movement. And as a contrast to the extreme right, I wanted to look at a group called Quilliam in London that helps jihadists get out of the movement. So I wanted to see if there were any differences really in those. And my work, Kate, really comes from one simple, utterly obvious demographic fact, which is the overwhelming majority. We're talking in the 90% range of people on the extreme right are or extremists, whether they're terrorists or lone wolves or members of particularly radical groups. Over 90% are men. I'll ask you or your audience the question: if 90% of the extremists were women, would we be talking about anything else but gender?
And you also find a common thread about masculinity, which follows that men get into these extremist groups very often have that this issues with masculinity. And you also noted that fact is rarely discussed. So why do you think masculinity has often been overlooked by other researchers in the field? And what is the link there between men and masculinity?
Okay, so, right. So the next question is, if, for example, virtually 100% of all of the rampage school shooters are boys, if over 90% of all of the violent extremists are men, you have to then ask the question: well, is there a link between masculinity and those behaviors, or is it something else? And there's a lot of options. You know, you could go make a kind of biological argument, but in the end, that doesn't hold up. You could try, as we do for the case of the school shooters, make a mental health argument. As you know, when white people commit mass murder, it's a mental health issue. When people of color do it, it's a race issue. It's a them issue, not an individual issue. And so I decided I wanted to look at the questions of masculinity. So when I talked to these guys, that's what they told me. It wasn't like I mean, yes, of course, I'm a sociologist and I study gender and I study masculinity, but they were telling me those stories. They were telling me stories of feeling as teenage boys in Sweden, middle school, 13, 14, 15 years old, isolated, bullied, not really doing well in school, no future, not really knowing what to do. And then these guys come along, and these skinheads, and they say, hey, come hang out with us, party with us. We're going to have a great time. We all get really drunk. There's girls. And then we all take painkillers, and we go out on the street looking for immigrants to beat up. It's fantastic. And these guys get into the movement not because of ideology. They don't get in because they've suddenly gotten these ideas and they look for a group to plug them in. They get involved because these skinheads provide them with camaraderie, brotherhood, community, family in many cases. The first time they feel really validated, really, you know, like their lives have meaning. Then later, after they've been partying, after they've been going and hanging out with these guys, then the ideology comes. Only later, after they've been doing stuff together, did they say, not only are you awesome, but you have a sacred mission to preserve the white race, and here's what you need to do. So, so for these guys, the ideology comes second. So what I came to understand is a lot of the efforts that law enforcement, that American policymakers are using to try to help these guys get out are misplaced. Because they'll go to these guys and say the equivalent of, you know, your interpretation of page 177 of Mein Kampf is wrong. And these guys look at you blankly and go, what? I never read it. You know, it's not why they're there. They're there because these groups provide community, solidarity, brotherhood. One guy who I interviewed, who was a neo-Nazi and skinhead in Philadelphia, told me that when he was a young boy, he would just get beaten up every single day by his stepfather. I mean, just, you know, pummeled and, you know, battered and broken. And one day, you know, he's 12 years old. He went out was on the street. He didn't have a place to stay. He was homeless at 12, dropped out of school. And so finally, when he started joining the, you know, skinheads, and they said to him things like, you know, oh my God, you're so awesome. You come from Philadelphia. You know how to deal with all those immigrants and all those people of color. You're so, you know, we really admire you. And he said to me once, that was the equivalent of somebody just saying, how was your day, son? How are you? Mm. Like somebody noticed him. I mean, so you weren't going to get him out by appealing to sort of political ideas. You were going to get him out by giving him some way to validate his masculinity outside the movement.
So where is recruitment happening? Is it on the streets? Is it within jails? And what is this? You had mentioned partying, but what is that timeline looking like as these young men get drawn into fringe groups?
Well, where recruitment is happening is an interesting question. It's happening, you know, all over the United States. In the difference between Germany, for example, where most of the guys who are recruited come in from either the former East, particularly East Berlin, or some Eastern cities, because that's, of course, their anti-Soviet, anti-Russian sentiment kind of goes back to the Second World War, pro-Nazi, anti-Russia. So there was they had a kind of tradition there. But most of the guys that I talked to actually were recruited when they were in prison for petty crimes, burglary, robbery, you know, sort of street crime. And there they go into a prison where it's very polarized. German prisons very often look like American prisons, which is to say that they're overwhelmingly minority populations, mostly Turkish prisoners. And so the white guys sort of get together there. They have a kind of neo-Nazi brotherhood, and that's how these guys get recruited. When they get released from prison, they're part of the movement. In the U.S., guys get in their teens. They get in high school, some middle school, but mostly through high schools. A lot of these extremist groups are recruiting right off high school grounds. They're hanging out at skateboard parks at, you know, in the early evening. They go to places where young guys are congregating, drinking beer out of paper bags on the street, and they just hang out and talk to them. The recruiting is very, very casual, camaraderie, friendship, and then later becomes ideological. So that's the way that these guys get in, is they're kind of, you know, just hanging out on the street. I mean, I met guys who were in, you know, recruited off of a skateboard park outside of Fallbrook, California, which is, you know, in that zone between L.A., Long Beach, for example, and San Diego. There's a sort of a large zone of sort of large tract houses and kind of aimless, alienated youth. And also, of course, in areas where that are formerly industrial centers that have fallen on harder times, where there's a lot of high levels of unemployment, a lot of these guys trace their origins to feeling economically displaced. You'll remember at Charlottesville, before it became anti-Semitic, the chant was, "You will not replace us," right? We are your work. We are the working class. We are the white working class. You're not going to replace us in this country. And that was their chant.
So when you talk and do these interviews with these dozens of people who are in these groups and who have found their way out of these groups, and you look at the structures in place in Germany, in Sweden, for getting these young men back on track in their lives, do these types of structures, how overt are they? How mainstream are they? And how are they even infiltrating fringe groups to get at these young men to bring them back?
Well, that's a really good question, and I'm afraid that it has a kind of sad answer. So the successful model is Sweden, where a neo-Nazi skinhead went to the minister for youth and explained to him that he wanted to start this organization called Exit. And the idea of the group, the idea of the movement, would be that it would be staffed by what they called formers, guys who were in the movement who would help other guys get out, because nobody who has not been in the movement can really understand it, can understand the visceral experience of having been in the movement. So and the Swedish government was all over it. They said, absolutely, we will fund it. It's located in the big youth house. In the middle of Stockholm, which has, you know, basketball courts and after-school programs and you name it. Exit is part of that. They have offices there. They do group therapy. They do job training programs. They have job placement services. They provide safe houses in case you or your family are being threatened.
So very much not underground, very much in the public community eye?
Absolutely. Exactly. Yeah. And I would be willing to bet that, you know, virtually everyone in the movement who's actually an active in the movement knows about Exit. By this point, they're so well known that, you know, anybody who's beginning to have some doubts knows where to go, knows a place to contact. Now, that's quite different from Germany, where Exit gets very little government support and it's quite clandestine, quite secretive, and the United States, where Life After Hate was founded in 2011 by some formers, and they had a closed Facebook group, which allows people to contact them and talk with them. In 2015, the Life After Hate was given one of the grants through the government, the Justice Department, for a program for combating violent extremism, CVE, it's called. And they were given a grant to start the Exit model, which was group therapy, job training. When the Trump administration came into power, what they decided was any group that was going to get government funding had to be about Muslim terrorists only. They were only interested in Islamic terrorism, and any group that was talking about domestic terrorism was not going to get any funding. So their funding was cut. They've now managed to piece it together through private funding, but our current government will not fund any program that has anything to do with domestic terrorism. They only are interested in Islamic terrorism.
We're talking with Stony Brook University sociologist Michael Kimmel, who is a leader in this field of masculinity studies. His new book is called Healing from Hate. He writes, today there are about 22,600 active neo-Nazis and members of other extreme right-wing groups in Germany. He studies the relationship between masculinity and extremist politics in our world, and in recent years, interviewing dozens of young men who break from extremist groups in Germany, in Nordic countries, the UK, the US. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the relationship between masculinity and extremism? Can a better understanding of masculinity and gender prevent young men from turning to extremist groups? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to the conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Sociologist Michael Kimmel has interviewed a number of young men trying to get at what are the pathways to extremism? What are the ways that young men become racist, anti-Semitic, or even anti-immigrant? His new book is called Healing from Hate, How Young Men Get Into and Out of Violent Extremism. He references in the book an NPR interview last year with Christian Piccolini, who spent his adolescence spreading fear and hate as a white supremacist leader. Here's an excerpt of that interview with Morning Edition's David Green.
One day I was standing in an alley at 14 years old and I was smoking a joint, and a guy drove up the alley and stopped 6 inches from me. And when he got out of the car, he walked towards me, grabbed the joint from my mouth, looked me in the eyes and said, "Don't you know that that's what the communists and the Jews want you to do to keep you docile?"
You can join in with your questions about the relationship between masculinity and extremism at 800-642-1234. What do you think could be done in schools and communities to thwart radicalization? Call in, tweet us at WPR Mornings. Michael, going back to that interview with Christian Piccolini, what struck you there about what he had to say about extremism and how he turned away from being a white supremacist leader?
Yeah, Christian's story is really an interesting one. I did interview him for my book, and he's an amazing guy. And his story is, he starts out by saying, I was standing in his alleyway smoking a joint at age 14. He wasn't in school. He was just hanging out by himself alone. And so this guy comes up to him and says, you know, that's the wrong thing to do. You know, here, hang with me. And so this is his beginning of his introduction. Now, Christian also found his way, as many of these guys do, found his way into the movement through the music scene. He was himself a musician. He ran a record store. And he started to stock music. The white power music is a genre that is really exciting, thrashy, punky, and loud. And these guys loved, you know, and so you go to a white power music festival, and it's as I said, about 90% guys all moshing in the center, having a great time. Getting really drunk, and so one of the things that Christian himself was saying is that this was community, this was solidarity, this was meaning in his life. Standing on a street in an alleyway smoking a joint at age 14, his life was aimless. Suddenly he had a purpose. Now, if you want to get somebody out, once they're in, you have to give them the opportunity to find a purpose outside the movement. Right? You can't just say you have to leave and sort of just jump off a cliff. You know, you have to give them a place to land.
But what was his turning point?
In Christian's case, or
in Christian's case, I mean, because he did have the birth of his child was a really pivotal moment. But he was also saying in this interview that he was beating up some guy and they made eye contact, and that was also something that was, you know, made a huge impact on him.
In Christian identifies two of the paths that many of these guys take. One is through a relationship. A lot of guys told me stories, for example. Some of the guys just age out. You know, what's fun to do when you're 16 is maybe not fun to do when you're 36. You know, so there are some just sort of natural aging out. But one thing was the power of a relationship outside the movement. Many of the guys told me that their girlfriends or wives said, okay, that's enough. You know, it's me or the movement. You have to make a choice. I can't live like this anymore. You know, you have to get a real job, et cetera. Many guys told me, Christian was not the only one, but many guys told me that the first time they held their child, a newborn baby, they looked at this baby and they go, what kind of world am I bringing this child into? You know, this I have to reform. I have to change. I at least have to leave the movement. Maybe I don't have to leave all my ideas, but I definitely have to leave the movement. I have to start, you know, sort of taking care of a child. So that was one route out. The other route out is by finding something else, some other place to land. So Christian says this about finding his, you know, seeing that in his child, but also beginning to feel like, you know, what I'm doing, the idea when he says he made eye contact with someone he was beating up, you know, one of the single, what's the best word for it? A kind of axiomatic in social psychology. If you want to reduce prejudice, the contact hypothesis is absolutely sort of boilerplate, axiomatic. Every social psychologist knows this, that if you want to break down racial differences, racial stereotypes, you put people together, but not just having a conversation, put them together doing something together. And racial stereotypes begin to break down. First, a little bit personally, like, oh, yeah, well, I really hate those people, but this guy's okay. And then gradually you sort of realize that those stereotypes are entirely fictitious. That's one of the reasons, just in parentheses, one of the reasons that we know, and this is true in Wisconsin, as it's true in, across the country, that those counties that were the most heavily pro-Trump were the least diverse. That is to say, they had the least contact with the other, the people who they were, quote, voting against, unquote. So one guy, for example, so Christian says that he makes eye contact with a guy he's beating up. Another guy says to me that, you know, he was in jail. And, you know, he was the guys who he hung out with, the guys who he started to talk to, they were African-American. And he realized, like, no, they're nothing like the stereotypes I have of them. I've hated them, but these guys are okay. And a woman who I interviewed had the same experience. Her cellmate was African-American. And she couldn't bear the idea that she was going to be in a cell with an African-American. And all these African-American women actually treated her okay. So here's the beginning of the breakdown is the humanizing of the other. The other is not some stereotype cartoon. They're actually a real person, and there's a person in there. I think that was Christian's moment in that fight, was there's a person in there. There's not just an object of my hatred. There's a human being in there. And once you make that connection, then you're able to sort of humanize the other in a way that makes it impossible to hate them as a group.
Paul from Eau Claire emailed and wonders, young white men today never actually experienced the privilege they are told that they have. They're taught relentlessly that what they are is a source of societal problems while also experiencing actual discrimination by affirmative action, bullying by females in modern dating. Reality is not matching the official story for young white men. So how does the idea of privilege factor in here?
Yeah, well, I don't want to argue about whether or not white men have privilege in this country. What I do know is that driving your car with a broken taillight could be a death sentence for an African American, and it's never a death sentence for a white man. So I would say yes, white men have a lot of privilege, but he's absolutely right that in their experience today, when white men used to have 95 to 96% of all the positions of power in government and corporate life, and now they only have 86%, it feels like, oh, my God, they're losing everything, and the tide has completely swung the other way. So let me say something about that. It's not whether or not they have privilege. It's whether they feel entitled to it. It's whether they feel entitled to those positions. What I came to understand as the motivation for so many of these guys was that they felt what I called aggrieved entitlement. These were our, you know, I think you hear this, for example, like my first encounter with angry white men was with four guys on the on a TV talk show who claimed that they, white men, as this guy emailing says, that these white men were the victims of reverse discrimination, affirmative action. And one of them said, this was the title of the show, "A Black Woman Stole My Job." And I thought, well, that's a really interesting way to think about it. Why did you think it was your job? Where did you get that idea? Why didn't you say a black woman got the job or a job? Because that's what entitlement sounds like. Those were our jobs. Is this our country or not? We, remember the motto of the Tea Party, we have to take back our country. And now you have to ask yourself, who's the we in that sentence? What does our country mean? Kate, the only people in the United States who could legitimately say we have to take our country back are Native Americans. Everybody else came on a boat, whether they wanted to or not. So let's be very clear about what that sense of entitlement is. We have to take that back. That's been taken from us. That's what aggrieved entitlement sounds like. So the conversation about privilege runs parallel to this. The real conversation is, what gives you the sense that you are entitled to these positions? Why does a level playing field threaten you so much? Why? Because you have always assumed that those were your jobs.
Looking at the young men that you talked with, was there a sense of remorse or regret in the years lost to joining extremism groups for the actions they took while in the groups? Or do they just shut the door on that part of life if they have been able to leave?
A little of both. Some feel tremendous remorse for the violence that they committed and seek some kind of way of repairing that. One guy I talked to, for example, spends a lot of time going around the country to Jewish communities and going to speaking at temples and Jewish community centers and yeshivas about his life as a neo-Nazi skinhead, because he feels like it's a way for him to sort of give back to a community that he vilified for so long. So many of them feel real regret for the actual physical violence they inflicted on other individuals. And some just regret, you know, like, oh my God, that was like 4 years of my life. I don't even know what happened. It was a sort of blind rage for several years. Others look back more philosophically at it, and others feel like, wow, that's what I did when I was an adolescent. Everybody goes through a phase.
But this would be a small slice of the overall population turning to extremism. Do we have to be careful here not to overgeneralize about men and boys?
Yes, of course. I'm in no way trying to explain. You know, first of all, I have two populations, one group that was still in the movement, but another group that had left the movement. And of course, the group that's left the movement is not indicative of the group, the guys who are still in it. These are the ones who chose to leave. So obviously the ideology in some cases was just not enough to sustain them after the sort of the physical part of the visceral part of the feeling camaraderie and connection and community. After that began to wane, after they had competing demands on them like family commitments or work commitments. So yes, of course, I'm not suggesting in any way that this is a large or mainstream movement, but I am suggesting that unless we pay attention to gender, we can't really understand how these guys get in, therefore how to get them out, what they're getting from it. I do think that there are other, of course, much larger structural causes, economic restructuring and downsizing, for example. One of the things that I found was many of these guys, in fact, almost all of the American guys I talked to, were what you would call downwardly mobile, lower middle class. And by that I mean their fathers were small farmers, but they lost the farm. Their fathers owned a small, ma and pa store that closed when a big box store like Walmart moved into the neighborhood. They were skilled workers in heavy industry, union protected, like auto and steel, which have completely been transformed in the U.S. Or finally, they were the skilled non-union craftsmen, construction workers, plumbers, electricians. They were the ones who had this, you know, the family craft, like, you know, Kimmel and Sons, you know, carpenters. And these were the sons. And so these guys grew up with an idea. This was our country. This was our work. This was our life. And if I did what my father and grandfather did, if I worked hard and I played by all the rules and I paid my taxes, that what would happen is I would be able to support a family by myself. My wife shouldn't have to work. I should do that by myself. I should be able to support a family and buy a house. And they can't. So they're furious. And that's what I call, that's the political economy, if you will, of that aggrieved entitlement sense. But the thing is that, and I said to these guys, you know, I actually believe these guys have been badly done by. They have been screwed. But what I tried to say to them is, do you really think that it was immigrants who gave you those predatory loans? Was it feminist women who caused climate change? Was it LGBT people who outsourced your job? I mean, of course, you're right to be angry, but you're delivering your mail to the wrong address. You know, the right address is those groups that have issued those predatory loans and outsourced your jobs, et cetera.
Let's bring in a call here. Let's go to John joining us from Brown Deer with thoughts on this. John, go ahead. Hi.
Yes, good morning, and thank you for accepting my call. And the question or comment that I have is that last night I viewed a program on Milwaukee Public Television. It was aired on the American Experience show, and it was titled The Chinese Exclusion Act. And it gave the historical background, focusing on the Chinese immigrants and how they were discriminated against officially through enactments through the United States Congress and in various states. And perhaps it would be fruitful for your guest to examine the historical roots of how the official American government abetted and aided the development of the legacy of hate groups over the various decades of American history.
John, thanks. Michael, go ahead.
Well, of course. I mean, I think that John gives us a very good, sort of recollection that this didn't come out of nowhere. This didn't start in the 1960s or 1970s. We have a long history of both government actions against immigrant groups and also government support for hate groups, sort of organizing and serving as kind of the shock troops. So, you know, the Chinese Exclusion Act and the treatment of the Chinese at the turn of the last century. I used to live in the Bay Area in California, and you know the signs of the Chinese Exclusion Act in San Francisco are really quite evident even today. The herding of Japanese Americans into concentration camps during World War II, the ways in which the American government has been complicit in this throughout our history gives you an idea that this is not something new. There is a long history of this, and I think that's an important piece of that as well.
The book is Healing from Hate, How Young Men Get Into and Out of Violent Extremism. Sociologist Michael Kimmel explores the process by which young men latch onto hate groups and how they become radicalized and what masculinity has to do with it. We're talking about masculinity and radicalization here on The Morning Show. You have a line at 800-642-1234. Where do you see glimmers of hope in helping young men find a sense of place and purpose? What support networks do you think would help the situation? Call in. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We're going to look at prevention when we get back to the conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Sociologist Michael Kimmel writes in his epilogue to his new book, Healing from Hate, we will need policies that enable these disaffected, disillusioned, disheartened men who simultaneously feel entitled and victimized, embattled and enraged, to feel that they belong and that they matter. We're talking about what needs to change to stop young men from entering toxic ideologies with no return. Here on The Morning Show, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Gathering your insights, your questions, they're welcome, 800-642-1234. What alternatives can be offered? What do you see working in your community or elsewhere in the world? You can call in or email ideas at WPR.org. Michael, I would imagine with all of these interviews you do, you try to look ahead and figure out where can we go from here? Where can we take this? What steps can happen here in the U.S. or what can we learn from other countries? What do we know there? Where does this go?
Okay, so this is a really great question. This is on the one hand, I found myself feeling so much more optimistic when I finished this book because here were guys who went to some of the darkest places you could imagine, and they found their way back to the light. They found their way back into the world through their relationships, through someone who helped them along the way, someone who saw them. So you have to ask and it gives you great hope that a guy who, you know, a couple 20 years ago had a big swastika tattooed on his neck is now working to create the opportunities for young white kids and African American kids to play hockey together. I mean, this is so, it fills you with optimism. But there are policies that we can develop that can really enable this. And let me give you a couple. I believe that on the individual level, the working with guys who are in the movement, who've already taken that step to get out, I think that's going to come from the formers themselves. I'm not going to give that advice. That's for them to figure out because they know.
And remind us of what formers are when you use that lingo, formers.
All right, so formers is the word that guys who were in the movement used to describe themselves, right? Guys who got out of the movement, they're formers. And they're the ones who run these organizations that I described, Exit in Sweden or Life After Hate. Now, the other thing, the other piece, though, in the U.S., and I can talk about some of the work in London on the jihadis as well, but in the U.S., one of the things that President Obama tried to do in his first month of office in 2009 was he said, I want to make community college free for everyone. And the reason that he said that was because he felt like he knew that there was a wide swath of America that was barely on the service road to the information superhighway, that had not connected to the new economy, to the new global opportunities, but then they needed a place to find a way into that new economy from these old traditional jobs that were disappearing. Bruce Springsteen once sang in my hometown, he said, the foreman says these jobs are going, boys, and they ain't coming back. And Bruce Springsteen was right. Donald Trump is wrong. They're not going to come back. And so we needed to give these guys a way in. And he said, let's make community college free. Well, of course, the Republicans shot that down within a heartbeat. But those are the kind of policies that say, okay, what are the long-term sources of this alienation, this disaffection, when you have such high levels of unemployment, when you have downward mobility in a country that is built on the idea that each generation is more successful than the next, then you have to give guys a way in. You have to give them a way to sort of retool so that they can participate in this new economy.
So when you look at these young men, do you keep tabs on whether they relapse or how their lives are today? Because you've been watching them for almost a decade as you wrote the 2013 book, and now here we are in 2018. How closely do you track their lives?
I don't. I know only anecdotally. Through my friends at Exit in Sweden and Life After Hate, they're successful. Of course, in Sweden, the guys find their way to Exit. and most of them are ready to leave. And if you can get them a job, and if they have a good relationship, and if they have what I keep calling a place to land, a place to stand, where they feel like they're validated, and that's the masculinity part, where they feel like people see them as a successful man, then the likelihood that they will relapse is very low. Of course, there's some relapsing, some of it through drugs and drinking and partying, some of it through, but little of it actually through ideology. And ironically, one of the things that's really interesting is one of the biggest differences between the Swedish skinheads and the American is what their politics look like after they leave the movement. The Swedish guys become, you know, social democrats. They're very strongly environmental, pro-environmental regulation, because they want to preserve the beauty of the Swedish countryside.
And environmentalism is much more of a male-type gender feeling in those countries,
yes,
than it is female?
Yes, exactly. And here we code environmentalism as so feminine. You know, regulate it, private industry, reduce entrepreneurship, and we think of it as a very liberal democratic idea. But for these guys, you know, you can imagine a kind of right-wing conservative environmentalism. The land is so beautiful, we have to conserve it for future generations. We shouldn't have, you know, we should move away from extractive industries. Really quite amazing how environmentally, sensitive the Swedish former right-wingers are.
We haven't talked about the role of social media, of chat rooms, of the online gathering of these groups. What impact has that made? And is there infiltration there to help get young men away from these types of groups before it's too late?
The answer to the second question is there infiltration? I suspect that many of these chat rooms, which I started my research going to some of these chat rooms, I assumed that there's a lot of people who are investigating and monitoring from law enforcement who are on these sites, sort of looking at who's speaking and who's talking about what. But the thing about these, the internet, is it provides community for people who often feel very isolated. This could be terrific, or it could be, you know, it could be problematic. The idea that, you know, you're by your, you know, I mean, think, for example, you know, in the past month, Kate, Americans have learned a new word, incel. We didn't know that word a month ago. Now everybody knows about it. But, you know, 20 years ago, incels, people who were involuntarily celibate, who basically couldn't have a date, couldn't get a date, couldn't have sex, you know, were being rejected all the time. They suffered in silence. They were despondent. They were depressed. They were miserable. You know, they self-medicated, but now they have a community, right? Now they have a place like they can go on the internet. So, I'm not the only person. And in these communities, whether they're, you know, whether they're extreme left or Antifa or extreme right and neo-Nazi, there's a kind of male camaraderie that develops through a kind of competitive banter. By which I mean, guys will say things like, "Oh well, I'm going to do this." "Oh yeah, well, I'll up you one. I'll do this," and that's a kind of male joshing with each other. You know, like, "I'll outdo you. I'll outdo you." So these guys get really riled up in these places, and I'm saying it knows no political ideology. The internet has a kind of neutral function in that it provides possibilities for community for people who might have been otherwise isolated.
So we have a caller here who wants to ask a question on this thread line. Do we know if we see less involvement in hate groups in countries where prostitution is legal? The caller says he's been thinking about this in light of this recent talk about incels and their talk about involuntary celibacy. Any link there?
Well, I think not. I don't think there's any evidence. I mean, incels are such a small group to begin with. The only cases where there has been, you know, dramatic violence from incels has been in North America, Canada, and the U.S. So I don't know the answer to that. I don't think prostitution is seen by incels as the answer.
Mm.
because it would be, in some cases, my guess is many incels might feel themselves to be unsuccessful as men if they have to pay for it. And I think that the literature on prostitution, for example, is quite different from men who can't get a date, men who feel themselves to be losers. Most of the men who buy sex have regular relationships, are married with, or have regular sex partners. It is not about guys who can't otherwise have sex.
Michael Kimmel, how do you plan on continuing this research? Where does it go from here?
Well, right now, I'm working with these groups. I continue to work with these groups and talk to them. My job in this work was really to try and identify the particularly gendered narratives that you hear from these guys, to sort of tell their story of what guys experience, what brings them into these movements, so that we, that is to say, you and I right now, and our country, can have a different conversation about how to help them, how to reach them, how to get them out. The answers to that are to give them a place to land. The answer is to find ways to develop programs like Exit to support groups like Life After Hate, which enable these guys to find a route out, to feel like, because many of these guys, even when they're in the movement at their peak, they sometimes start to feel trapped. Like, oh, God, I saw that guy who tried to leave and everybody beat him up. Maybe I shouldn't go there. And they begin to feel a sense of despair in the group that they also felt out of it. I think we also have to be aware that the neo-Nazi, far-right extremist groups are beginning to bifurcate in the sense that there still are those guys in black leather vests with no shirts and Confederate flag bandanas and all of that. And then there are the guys who are wearing, the polo shirts and khakis at Charlottesville. Notice, by the way, they were all guys, again. With their tiki torches. I mean, one of the most, so there is a moment in which there's a kind of mainstreaming under this current administration that says that they're such nice people. So I think there is an element of mainstreaming that we do have to be aware of. To me, one of the most delicious ironic moments in watching the videos from Charlottesville is seeing David Duke, the former Grand Wizard of the Louisiana Ku Klux Klan, addressing the crowd wearing a polo shirt with a little polo player on it. That is a shirt designed by a Jew, Ralph Lauren, to imitate upper-class WASPs who played polo. And I thought, I couldn't have scripted that one.
Well, Michael Kimmel, I think we need to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much, Kate. Good to be with you.
Michael Kimmel is a distinguished professor of sociology and gender studies at Stony Brook University, where he founded the Center for the Study of Men and Masculinities. He's written several books, and his latest one is called Healing from Hate: How Young Men Get Into and Out of Violent Extremism. This hour, The Morning Show was produced by Chris Molina. Michael Derringer provided technical support. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this conversation comes to you on the Ideas Network.